Hello there. Today is Wednesday, January 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the new Republican Congress begins with controversy.
Getting rid of that is a violation of the public trust.
But lawmakers are looking to quickly repeal President Obama's signature health care law.
Defunding and repeal of the Affordable Care Act is high on their list.
We also find out just how crowded the skies are with planes and the drama over pop singer Mariah Carey's New Year's Eve performance continues. It's all on today's International Edition. The 115th session of Congress in the United States began Tuesday with the swearing-in of members and the re-election of Paul Ryan as House Speaker.
Congratulations, you are all now members of the 115th Congress.
But a rare opportunity for one-party leadership in Washington got underway as Capitol Hill returned to work for the first day with a Republican-controlled government as the party's ambitious legislative agenda fell to the wayside as a move by House Republicans to change the rules for ethics investigations of lawmakers dominated the day's discussion. VOA's Catherine Gibson reports from Capitol Hill.
Controversy on the first day of Congress. Republicans and Democrats sparring as they hold what are usually routine leadership elections. The flashpoint? Republicans proposing changes in House rules limiting an independent watchdog office's ability to investigate lawmakers' ethical breaches. The closed-door late-night vote sparked outrage among Senate Democrats.
This has been an independent entity to sort of screen complaints to see which ones might have merit. Getting rid of that is a violation of the public trust. Well, obviously, it's helping increase the size of the swamp and giving the swamp even more power.
And on her first day on Capitol Hill, freshman Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy saying the changes would scrap accountability for her and her colleagues.
I don't think that that's really the tone that we should be setting out on in this 115th Congress.
President-elect Donald Trump, who campaigned on the popular line about D.C. corruption, drain the swamp, tweeted the timing wasn't right. Just as the pomp and circumstance of swearing in leadership and new members got underway, Republicans backed down. The changes were too big a distraction as Capitol Hill Republicans looked to the hard work ahead.
I know we have a lot of work ahead of us, and I don't have any doubt that with a little cooperation, we can make the 115th Congress a productive one that meets the needs of the American people.
A message of cooperation echoed by Paul Ryan as he was reelected Speaker of the House.
However bright of a contrast that we draw between us, it must never blind us to the common ground that we share.
And by Nancy Pelosi as she returned in her role as House Minority Leader.
We have the responsibility and the power to lift the lives and the hopes of the American people.
But on just this first day of the 115th Congress, the most hopeful signs for the future could be public outcry over the controversy, says former Bush administration ethics czar Norm Eisen.
Even the president-elect followed along with that popular tide, and it gives me hope that the American people are up to their responsibilities to do oversight and accountability over one-party rule of the White House and the Congress.
A sign that even as Congress moves ahead with an ambitious agenda, Republican leadership will be listening to the voters. Catherine Gibson on Capitol Hill, VOA News.
I promise to hear you out and let you have your say.
Well, one of the big issues, one of the top things on the agenda for Republicans is repealing President Obama's signature health care law. Joining me for more on just how quickly that could happen is healthcare attorney Harry Nelson, who has a new book coming out next week called From Obamacare to Trump Care, Why You Should Care. Thank you so much for being with us. So just how easy will it be for them to actually overturn the Affordable Care Act?
The Republicans have a clear path to the repeal through the defunding mechanism of budget reconciliation. They have a majority to pass any legislation that they favor, and clearly a repeal, a defunding, and repeal of The Affordable Care Act is high on their list.
Now, they're promising to repeal and replace, but we have not heard about a plan to replace that. The last I heard was Donald Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway saying it was going to be done piecemeal, but my understanding is that's not really how the law works.
This is going to unfold on several levels. When we saw the Republicans actually succeeded in December 2015 in actually passing a repeal through both houses of Congress, and that bill included a two-year delay to defunding, which is what we expect here, which saves the Republicans any political damage of defunding until the midterm elections. But what we expect, and what I think Kellyanne Conway is alluding to, is that the piecemeal aspect is going to be a lot of administrative action that's going to at least make less functional some of the parts of the ACA that the Republicans object to, like the insurance exchanges, for example, and essentially to make the sort of gears of the ACA work less well in the areas that Republicans don't like.
Isn't it true that all of the parts need to work together in order for the thing to even work at all, as far as one part paying for another part? So if you derail some of it, then none of it works?
The target of actually making the ACA financially viable depended on all of the working pieces of it. But there are distinct pieces, right? Whether you are a person who is receiving Medicaid as a result of the ACA expansion, or whether you're a person who didn't have insurance either because you were unemployed or you had work that didn't give you insurance and you bought it through the insurance exchange, you're in a different category. And finally, everybody who's getting employer-based coverage is in a third category. So all of these groups are affected differently. The people who are most vulnerable are the people who are getting Medicaid or getting individual policies through the exchanges. The whole financial system under which the ACA was operating is going to fall apart, except to the extent that the Republicans actually defund. It's going to get more expensive and more of a financial mess. But I think that's partly what the Republicans are okay with, you know, as it relates to some pieces of the ACA. So, for example, in the insurance exchanges, there'll be more cost imposed on insurance companies, and so policies are going to get more expensive and less attractive, and insurance companies are likely to either pull out and stop offering policies on the exchanges or offer policies that consumers won't find attractive.
What happens to all those people that would otherwise be uninsured, that would not have health care anymore?
That's the billion-dollar question. I worry for a lot of people who have benefited the most from the Affordable Care Act being sort of thrown back into a lot of uncertainty about somebody getting sick, about having less access to preventive care for the kinds of health conditions that shorten lives and that really detract from the quality of life, whether it's heart disease or diabetes. I think we're going to see a lot of people who benefited the most actually suffering. Unless Donald Trump steps in as a wild card and does something to change the Republican vision of what comes next. And so one of the things that we're looking for, as somebody who believes that the Medicaid expansion was an important thing that alleviated a lot of human suffering in this country, we're hoping that Donald Trump will use that same independent spirit to stop some of the stripping of coverage of people who are depending on Medicaid. We think that the big changes are still 2 years away, but we're going to see a lot of small changes as the Republicans pick apart the parts they don't like.
So theoretically, people might feel like, oh, it happened and nothing really happened to me. But then 2 years later, boom. We'll start.
That's exactly what we're afraid of. The repeal decision may be, you know, we may be looking at it in the rearview mirror as of next month. But the big, big choices and the big potential loss of coverage for Americans is still going to be ahead of us. And which is why we're issuing a call to action for anybody who is concerned about the future of U.S. healthcare to keep pressure on our legislators and on the administration to move us forward and rather than backward in terms of fixing U.S. healthcare.
That's healthcare attorney Harry Nelson, who has a new book coming out next week called From Obamacare to Trump Care, Why You Should Care. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Donald Trump slams General Motors for making cars in Mexico. Serial killer Charles Manson has been transferred from prison to the hospital. Turkey's parliament extends the state of emergency. And new technology may help those waiting for heart transplants. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thank you. VOA's International Edition continues now. One major national security issue that will likely top the agenda of the incoming president is North Korea's nuclear ambitions. The reclusive leader mentioned recently its progress on nukes in his annual New Year speech to his nation. And President-elect Donald Trump responded in a tweet saying North Korean nukes are not going to happen. White House spokesman Josh Earnest talked about it with reporters on Tuesday.
And I can confirm once again that the United States military does believe it has the capacity to protect the American people from the threat that's emanating from North Korea.
Well, joining me now from Japan is East-West Institute Senior Fellow Jonathan Miller. Thank you so much for being with us. How concerned should we be about Kim Jong-un's comments? And also, how do you perceive Donald Trump's tweets?
I think we have to be a little bit cautious, though, on the things that the president-elect tweets. I mean, I think there's a sense, whether it be the South China Sea or China policy or other things, there's been a previous precedent where we would take the president's words very literal, but I'm not quite sure we can do that with Trump. So I kind of joke sometimes that we're not only in the post-truth era, but we're in the post-nuance area where we don't necessarily know exactly what Trump means by the fact that North Korea is not have a full nuclear deterrent. We don't really know what he means by that. Does he mean that they don't have the capabilities, or does he mean that he's not going to allow them through preemption or things? As far as the North Koreans and their capabilities, and whether this is a surprise, whether this is a shock, this has been a pretty consistent pattern of provocations, gradually upgrading their capabilities. So it doesn't really surprise me, and they've had a history of testing new incoming presidents as well. So it's not very surprising to me that they're kind of choosing this time to just before Trump takes office to kind of put a testing ground out there to see what the response might be.
Do you think that taking this tough guy stance in a tweet could ultimately taunt Kim Jong-un to want to try harder to actually do damage to the U.S.? Or do you think it's a deterrent?
I wouldn't necessarily say almost either. I don't think it's really deterrent in the sense that really almost virtually any action that the United States has taken in the last 10 years has failed to kind of change Kim's strategic calculus when it comes to the nuclear weapons program. It's potential that Kim is trying to position himself through further provocations like this, trying to put himself into a position where he can get Trump one-on-one or the U.S. one-on-one for negotiations, kind of basically putting a wedge in between the U.S. and its allies, Japan and South Korea. I don't necessarily think that Trump's language would endanger the U.S. more than the current state. I mean, I think the Kim regime, although it has no desire to roll back its program, I think it very clearly knows the consequences of any provocation that would affect U.S. interests, let alone U.S. mainland.
Are you saying that we shouldn't be worried about it, that we shouldn't worry because they wouldn't actually follow through with anything because they know that it would come right back to them?
No, I mean, we definitely have to worry. I mean, I think while they know the consequences of striking the U.S. or striking its allies, I think the issue is less, the concern. I mean, there's always a concern of the use of nuclear weapons, even at the smallest probability. So I'm not going to completely eliminate that. But it's the idea of nuclear blackmail and the idea that the North can basically have carte blanche in the region through conventional provocations, through other destabilizing activities or ties. The United States and its allies really have no power to push them in another direction. I mean, I think that's the big issue, is that the North feels like once it has its full deterrent capability that the United States will have no influence on it. And I think that's kind of more of the issue, is that North Korea basically being able to do whatever it wants in a region that is already quite on eggshells.
Is there anything the U.S. or any of North Korea's neighbors can do to stop it from continuing to go forward with nuclear ambitions?
With North Korea, I mean, almost every option has been tried. I mean, saving kind of preemptive action, which has very dangerous potential consequences. I mean, that's the reason that one hasn't been tried, just because of the vulnerability of U.S. forces in Seoul, the vulnerability of South Korea itself, and then Japan as well, and U.S. forces in Japan. I think the incoming Trump administration seems to be kind of, at least through its tweeting power, it seems to be kind of hinting that China is the problem and that everything can be kind of resolved through having a tougher line vis-a-vis China. I'm not fully sold on that line. I know that China has interest in protecting the status quo, and it doesn't want to have stronger sanctions on North Korea. But China also has limited options on North Korea as well, and it can't fully control what decisions the Kim regime makes. So I'm not quite sure that Trump can just have a silver bullet by striking some deal with China.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. East West Institute Senior Fellow Jonathan Miller. Well, the skies are more and more crowded. The International Civil Aviation Organization said Monday that worldwide air passenger traffic grew 6% in 2016 with 3.7 billion passengers transported by the world's air carriers. Jeffrey Thomas with the Australia-based airline ratings.com website tells VOA's Victor Beatty the rise in airline traffic is directly linked to lower airfares.
One thing seems to be constant. Air travel continues to grow as airfares continue to decline, particularly in relation to average weekly earnings. It's never been cheaper to fly than it is today.
Is that because of airline efficiency, or is that because of the low cost of oil?
Well, it's a combination of both. It's certainly airline efficiency combined with aircraft efficiency. For instance, Airbus's latest A320neo, which is being delivered now to airlines around the world, it burns about 14% less fuel than the previous A320 model. The same with the 737 MAX, which we delivered this year to the first launch customer, Southwest. Again, a 14 to 15% reduction in fuel burn over the previous model. So it's those sorts of efficiencies that the aircraft manufacturers are bringing to the table, airline efficiency as well with computerization. They're combining together with the new low-cost model of paying for nothing but the seat from point A to point B with no frills. All of those factors combine to make travel incredibly cheap compared to what it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago.
The ICAO, as it's called, says growth of passenger traffic was most pronounced in the Middle East, Asia, Latin America, and Africa. Why?
Well, these are what we would call developing markets, where people have not been traveling because of the state of the particular economies, if you like. It may well be, for instance, in Asia, where low-cost carriers are a more recent phenomenon. AirAsia, for instance, was only formed about 15, 16 years ago. Jetstar Group, which is originally based in Australia, now throughout Asia, that was also created at the same time. So these are recent phenomena, whereas, say, Southwest has its roots back in the 1970s in Texas. So low-cost airlines really took off in the United States, then spread to Europe, and then spread to the Middle East and Asia, and also Latin America with an airline like Gol. So the low-cost phenomena is more recent in those markets that you mentioned.
That's Jeffrey Thomas with the Australia-based airlineratings.com website. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Turning now to the lighter side of news with what's happening in Hollywood. We're joined by Entertainment Tonight's senior news editor, Jennifer Perros. Hi, Jen. Great to have you back. Happy New Year. So back and forth continues over pop star Mariah Carey's disastrous New Year's Eve performance where she botched her lip syncing. What's the latest with that?
I know, and now it's kind of gone to the point where it's like a he said, she said. So Mariah's management team is basically telling everybody that it was Dick Clark Productions' fault, that they gave her a faulty earpiece, and Mariah had spoken up about 10 minutes before she went on stage. She sang live on New Year's Eve that her earpiece was broken and they wouldn't replace it. They really didn't care, and that they wanted her to fail. Of course, that is not true.
Well, that's Dick quite Clark an accusation.
It's a very strong accusation. And now, Mariah is saying that, they just wanted to sabotage her for higher ratings on New Year's Eve. And another case that she's making, too, which kind of makes sense, in my opinion, she's basically saying, they didn't cut it out of the West Coast feed because, of course, the West Coast sees the New Year's Eve show 3 hours later than the East Coast. And she said, listen, you could have cut the commercial if you really thought it was bad, or you could have cut it out and filled it in with some fluff for the West Coast feed. And, of course, Dick Clark Productions did not do that. And then on their end, they're also saying, we gave the opportunity for Mariah to do a sound check, which she showed up for around 3 p.m. in Times Square that day. But sources tell ET she really wasn't doing anything. You know, she came in big sunglasses. She was taking pictures on her phone. She was talking on the phone the entire time. She actually didn't even rehearse. She didn't sing. So, yeah, of course, a lot of back and forth going on right now. But the only thing that this is definitely going to bring is more viewers to Mariah's reality show. That's for sure.
Is she really putting together a reality show?
Mariah Carey, yes. She has a show out right now on an E! Network, Mariah's World, and it kind of looks at her personal life and being on tour and what she has to do, you know, to perform after such a young career. What everyone is saying now is like, listen, Emotions is a very hard song to sing, but the song that she's been singing for 20 years, you know, as somebody who's won so many Grammys as Mariah Carey, you'd think she'd know the song by heart. But, hey, I guess I can't talk. I've never performed live in Times Square before on New Year's Eve, so it's got to be tough.
What would be the point of lip syncing?
Well, that's what a lot of people are saying now. And, you know, artists like Josh Groban and there's a few other people saying, you know, if you're lucky enough to be invited to Times Square on New Year's Eve to perform, you know, sing it for yourself. Don't lip sing. But, you know, what sources close to Mariah are telling ET now is, you know, it's a big space. It's pretty loud. You know, even if you try to sing live, it's extremely tough. So I think a lot of that is up for debate.
All right. Well, we will continue to follow it. Entertainment Tonight senior news editor Jennifer Parros, thanks so much. Joining me now for what's trending on social media, G. Abby Lee. What's the word today, G?
Hey, Lori. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is trending on the web with a Twitter Moments page describing the tweets as Biden doing Biden things. The vice president was at a swearing-in ceremony of newly elected senators for the last time in his tenure as VP.
Ah, so what are these so-called Biden things?
Lori, your guess is as good as mine. Kissing babies and making uncensored remarks. One of the most watched clips from the ceremony was one of Biden trying to kiss a baby from Senator Burr's family, who is a senator from North Carolina. C-SPAN, which is an American cable network, as you know, used hashtag BidenCam to tweet about the event.
Cool. Well, so what else is trending?
With inauguration just a couple of weeks away, all eyes are on who will be in attendance, and that's what reporters are tweeting about. Back in late December, the only former president that committed to attending Donald Trump's inauguration was President Jimmy Carter. Now it looks like both Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton will be at the inauguration, along with George W. Bush and his wife, Laura. Bush's father, former President George H.W. Bush, will not attend.
Wow, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. Anything besides politics happening?
The last item is also from the U.S., but about celebrity Kim Kardashian. I know, information you couldn't live without. The usually prolific Twitter user sent out her first tweet since last October, which was when she suffered robbery in Paris. She posted a photo of herself, husband Kanye West, and their two children, and captioned it, "Family." Many of her fans are tweeting, "The Queen is back." Back to you, Lori.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at G. Abby Lee. Or excuse me, at VOA_IE. The internet is a wild and sometimes wacky place. What starts as a simple video of people standing perfectly still can explode on social media in a matter of minutes. VOA's Arash Arabasadi takes a look back at some of what went viral in 2016.
Each year in the era of social media is another year in viral videos. Take, for instance, this year's mannequin challenge. It is basically people standing perfectly still, but a few American police departments joined the fun. Candace Payne bought herself a birthday present of a mask of Chewbacca from Star Wars. She laughed her way to a record-breaking 164 million Facebook views. Payne, known widely as Chewbacca Mom, appeared on several TV shows and people started buying the mask. She raked in thousands of dollars of goodies from the manufacturer and the retailer. A university in Florida even offered both of her kids full scholarships. Yeah. All I do is win, 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 no matter what. DJ Khaled is a gold and platinum selling musician. The U.S.-born son of two Palestinian parents describes himself as a devout Muslim. But that's not what landed him on the cover of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine in 2016. This was.
The key is not to drive your jet ski in the dark.
What started as a video of Khaled getting lost in the water went viral. And so did this Snapchat video of his wife giving birth to their son. President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden are no strangers to viral video.
Mr. President, you ready to move?
Absolutely. Let's do this thing. Let's move.
In a 2016 White House video, the president flipped cue cards while MEGA award-winning playwright and composer Lin-Manuel Miranda freestyle rapped about the government and Obama's last year in office.
How good is that? You think that's going viral? That's going viral.
But rounding out 2016, it was Biden's turn to go viral. The so-called no-jo viral sensation was as much a goodbye to Obama and Biden as it was a look ahead to Trump and his vice president, Mike Pence. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Well, that does it for today's show. We appreciate you being here for us. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains committed to protecting religious minorities, their communities, and their culture worldwide. This is an important expression of the values of the United States, in that we want to protect diversity of thought and belief, said Knox Thames, Special Advisor for Religious Minorities in the Near East and South Central Asia. This effort, said Special Advisor Thames, is of great importance in Syria and Iraq, where ISIL or Daesh seek to wipe out much of civilizational history.
In that work, we saw where Daesh was committing genocidal acts against Christians, Yazidis, and Shia Muslims. At the same time that they were killing people, they were also trying to erase any evidence that they ever existed, destroying their churches, their mosques, their cemeteries. And if we were going to defeat Daesh militarily, we also need to take steps to protect the places that matter to these people that they're also trying to exterminate. And so from that work, we started focusing on protecting the cultural heritage of religious minorities.
The U.S. State Department partnered with the Smithsonian Institution to engage religious minority groups directly, providing them with training and information on preserving cultural sites and objects that are at risk. Some of these preventative methods are simple but effective, said Special Advisor Thames.
There was a training that went on in northern Syria where churches were trained about how to stack sandbags in front of ancient frescoes and murals, so that if a mortar shell were to land, the explosive force would be dissipated by the sandbags. It wouldn't hurt the mural. And they had these very striking before and after pictures of a room full of sandbags. The bomb tragically hit. The sandbags are exploded, but the mural is fine.
Trainings also include information on protecting movable artifacts by creating digital documentation of the items that can be stored remotely. The Smithsonian Institute has created a special outreach program in Erbil, Iraq, that is dedicated to the effort. These communities that are so unique, that create this mosaic of culture and religion, said Special Advisor Thames, they can be pieced together, and protecting their common culture can be a way to do that.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for, what's your